Guess I'll put my glasses on so I can see. Well, I can talk without seeing, but when it comes to reading, it's something else. I am so impressed with this part area in Job. It's when God is speaking to Job after the many faults that Job seems to have found with his plight or with his condition. And but I just don't believe that God was speaking to Job in an angry manner. That it's more a manner that he wants Job to see himself and see what or how his relationship is to God. And I just can't see our God who is love using a big sledgehammer to hammer Job down. So I will try to convey that as I read, so you'll see why I read the way I do. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds in garments and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, 'This far you may come, but no farther, and here your proud waves must stop.' Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth? And the wicked be shaken out of it? It takes on form like clay under a seal and stands out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. Have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of it, of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place, that you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths to its home? Do you know it? Because you were born then? Or because the number of your days is great? Have you entered the treasury of the snow? Or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste, and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass. Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? The waters harden like stone, and the froze, and the surface of the deep is frozen. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades, or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season, or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds, that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings, that they may go and say to you, "Here we are"? Who has put wisdom in the mind, or who has given the understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds by wisdom, or who can pour out the bottles of heaven when the dust hardens in clumps and the clouds cling together? Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to wait and wait, to lie in wait? Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain. They depart and do not return to them. Who set the wild donkey free, or loose the bonds of the onager? Whose home I have made the wilderness and the barren land his dwelling. He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he stretches and he searches after every green thing. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed in your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home the grain and gather it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are their wings and pinions like the kindly stork's? For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them, or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly, as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern, because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and anger, nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, "Aha!" He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey. Its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, "Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further." Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Now, prepare yourself like a man. I will answer you, and you shall answer me. I will question you, and you shall answer me." Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God? Or can you thunder with a voice like His? Then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor, and array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in the hidden darkness. Then I will confess to you that your own right hand can save you. Look now at the behemoth which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brook surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes in his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle? Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false, since one can be overwhelmed at the sight of him. Shall one be overwhelmed at the sight of him? Oh, no, one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together and cannot be parted. His sneezings flash forth light. His eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. Strength dwells in his neck, and sorrow dances before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They are firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potsherds. He spreads pointed marks in the mire. He makes the deep like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. On earth there is nothing like him which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, Who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes.
Okay, wasn't that great? That was just beautiful to see the whole sweep of that poetry all in one reading. I think it's just absolutely amazing. And I think, you know, particularly in this age of scientific naturalism where God has been totally explained away and we have no need for God, the so-called disappearing God of the gaps, to see this, I've been thinking this week about what it would be if God called me aside and spoke to me like this, or called any one of us aside and spoke to us like this with this, what a absolutely incredible experience, overwhelming and humbling and enlightening. I think maybe some of you have had God speak to you at some time, maybe in one of those little almost audible voices where he gives you a little insight or a word of wisdom or maybe a little correction, which is scary. And here's a whole discourse. The rest of today and then in January, we want to go through this a little bit more in detail and make sure that you see the great themes that are in here. Remember that we've just finished long speeches from Job's three friends, all of whom have decided that Job is guilty and has sinned and is in big trouble and needs to repent. And then we had this young man, Elihu, come along with his insights, and he didn't quite get it right either. And this whole time when Job's been crying out for God to answer him, there hasn't been a word out of the Lord since this whole ordeal started. What a hard time it is to go through a time of suffering and not know why you're going through it, and to cry out to God and get no answer, and to become so wrapped up in your own little world, in your own little sphere, as to lose maybe the bigger picture. And when God speaks, he does not answer any of Job's questions. Doesn't engage Job on any of the issues that Job wants to talk about. He doesn't condemn Job. Doesn't find any fault in Job. He simply takes Job on this little tour of the universe with, I think, a lot of irony and a lot of humor and just in a delightful way. Look how great I am. Look how big I am. And look, in comparison with who I am, your little world of problems is really nothing. And I think that's the overall theme in here. There are some ideas that flow through here. In the beginning of chapter 8, we had the God of creation, the God who takes Job on a little tour of the creation of the universe, kind of echoing Genesis chapter 1. Where did the universe come from, Job? Were you there when I laid the foundations of the world? Were you there when I built the universe? Well, actually, nobody was there except probably some angels watching. We get this little picture in Genesis of the creation in 6 days, but there's a great deal that remains mysterious. And Job's also a late comer on here. You know, this little taunt in here we talked about last time where God says, "Were you born then? If you're really so smart and you really know so much, then let's talk man to man. Let's have a nice talk. I'd like to have you as my peer so we can have a kind of a man to man talk." That's the challenge here. Job, stand up like a man and we'll have a nice talk. Father-son talk or person-to-person talk. And you can tell me what it was like when the universe was created. And let's go back and remember when you were born, 70 years ago or something like that. Well, so last week we got down kind of in chapter 38 through verse 30 or so. In this picture of creation. And the creation of the universe, the rotation of the earth on its axis, we've already had the idea that the earth is a sphere. God putting the oceans in great basins and holding back their limits, and God responsible for the dawn and the rising of the sunshine, and also for the dispelling of darkness and wickedness. We had this imagery of hail stored up in great warehouses so that God could dispense it as he wishes, and the same with lightning and and thundered as if he had these resources that he could call on at any time from a big warehouse and dispense them as he wanted. And if he wanted rain, he could have rain anytime and anywhere. And so God's in control of everything. That's the whole the imagery in here. And God takes delight in, obviously enjoys his creation, and he enjoys the management of his creation. He delights in it. It's not our world, really. Man came along as the last of God's creations on the sixth day of creation week, after all the animals had been created, after the whole infrastructure was and life support system was in place, and here's the God who delights in putting rain out in the desert where no man ever goes, and causing flowers to bloom in a place where no man will ever visit, just for his own good pleasure. Well, do you understand those things? Could you do that? Well, Glenn Miller, you know, always had that little joke about creating a universe in the palm of your hand by just ordering it into existence and saying, I create a universe. Have you ever tried that? Does it work? We're very creative. God made us very creative, but our creation, our work is always imitative. And we can't really do anything as nearly as original as God bringing things into existence out of nothing. And that's all kind of taunt in here. And if you're really down and depressed, what's the best therapy? Trip to Yosemite or a walk along the beach or go to your nearby park and walk through the flowers, the rose gardens down by the anarchist house. It's just a gorgeous place. Just go. Get away from your problems and the internet and the house and the dirty dishes in the sink and just go for a walk in the park. I think that's the idea here. Doesn't that get your mind off of your petty little troubles and your hardships? Well, that's the whole idea in this. In verse 31, we had where we kind of stopped last week. We had the Pleiades. Pleiades and Orion and the Great Bear were all named here as constellations in the ancient sky 4,000 years ago. The stars don't move very much. Some of them don't move much in 4,000 years. So you can still look and see the Pleiades, the seven sisters, high in the winter sky, I think. And Orion is a winter constellation. You probably have seen Orion and the Great Bear, the Big Dipper, revolving around the North Pole. Are you all familiar to you? He chose northern hemisphere constellations, didn't bother to tell us about the southern hemisphere stars, which are quite different, but that's detail. Job would never have seen the stars of the southern hemisphere across the equator, so we just don't bother to bring that out. But don't challenge Job on things like that. No, is there life on Mars? That doesn't come up. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? That suggests an early Hebrew astrology. It suggests it. Doesn't prove it. That there may have been, the constellations may originally have been signs in the heavens that pointed out the history of Israel and the coming of the Messiah. Our astrology today is corrupt. So you don't go get astrology out of the morning paper. That's Babylonian astrology and it's occultic. But there are scholars that think there originally was a gospel in the stars. And in a place like Jordan or Israel where there's no city lights, every night when you go to bed, you see the blazing stars of the heavens and meteors and the planets wandering through. And you take your kids outdoors and enjoy the splendor of the sky. You can't do that around here. Even people that have fine telescopes have to get out of town to look up at the stars. But in the ancient world, the stars would be there every night. There's then this little meteorology section in chapter 38, verse 34. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds, that an abundance of water may cover you? Up around Seattle, they've had much, much more rain this year than they wanted, and now suddenly cold, and we have some climbers on Mount Hood that are still lost, and the winds are blowing 50 miles an hour, and it's bitterly cold. It's a little chilly here, too. Far, far too much rain up in the Pacific Northwest. Whose fault is that? Well, it's God did that. Does he explain why he did it? No, he doesn't tell us why. We have seasons of drought and seasons of rainfall here, and what can we do about that? We can't even predict it accurately. I like to watch the weather and the evening news because they always get it wrong. It never turns out that way, hardly ever. 50% of the time, he can be right by chance. Yeah, I think so. With the new computers, you can get a pretty good idea of a weather system. And the weather satellites are just incredible. Can Job, at this point, is Job experiencing the love of God? Well, I'm sure he's overwhelmed. I'm sure he's beginning to be humbled a little bit. This dialogue is broken in half, as we saw during the reading. There's a pause here in which Job seems to be partway there, but he's not all the way there and where God wants him. And so God takes up the discourse again. And the next section, which we'll get to, is a little more heavy duty, a little more penetrating. Job, do you see your self-righteousness? Do you see your pride? Do you see your view of things is a little off base? It comes in two parts. So there's something profoundly humbling going on in this. And in the end, Job will, I think, realize that God loves him, that there is a mediator, that his relationship with God is important, that he's just had a great privilege of having this tour from the Creator of the universe, who loves him. And wants the whole thing about Job is God wants a more intimate relationship with God and wants to bless him more and hasn't been able to. And without these horrendous trials, Job would never be able to enjoy this bountiful blessing that comes at the end of the book. So there's purpose in all this suffering. We get the meteorology at verse 34. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds, that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go? Thunder and lightning. Are you in charge of those great ferocious Midwestern thunderstorms? Well, hardly. Can you tell, have the lightning answer to you? You call for the lightning and the lightning says, here we are. What do you want, Lord? Can you command a bolt of lightning like that? And there's a little bit here, a little section on psychology. Who has put wisdom in the mind, or who has given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can pour out the bottles of heaven when the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together? Job's friends have all been wondering where wisdom is to be found in the world. And there's now a little hint that there's really only one source of wisdom, and that's God himself. Just this little hint. If you stop and think about how is it that you understand things? How is it you remember things? How is it that you get wisdom? Where does that come from? What is it anyway? I'm sure some of you have lots of wisdom in some areas, and you maybe would like, well, where'd that come from? What is it anyway that causes you to learn how to make good decisions and good choices in life? Well, that's from God by a process we can't fathom. Now we switch to the God of nature at verse 39. We've had this tour of the creation, and now we switch to that God is the manager of nature. Hands-on management. He created the universe hands-on like an artisan. Now he manages it in all of its details. Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Somebody's got to feed those lions and those tigers and leopards and those wild animals. They are going to roam around out on the plains of Africa, and they got to eat. Are you going to be responsible for feeding them so that they don't starve to death? You're going to be responsible for them catching a wildebeest, a beast, or an antelope, or eating, and their cubs have got to eat. Are you managing that sort of thing? Good heavens, we're just go to the San Francisco Zoo and visit the lions up there if you want to be filled with terror, awesomeness of real lions. And the idea here is that God is taking care of all those animals, and he understands them, and he worries about them, make sure they eat. And the little baby lions that are cute as little kittens, they're all waiting for mom to go out and get something so they can eat. And God's doing that over the centuries. He's taking care of feeding the animals. And then he immediately switches from a lion to a raven. Goes quite to the other end. Ravens are, you know, birds that we don't have a very high regard for, but God feeds the ravens. And then think of the little raven chicks, the little baby ravens. If you've seen baby birds, they're absolutely helpless. They have just a few little feathers. They're absolutely vulnerable in their nest. And they've got to be fed, because if they aren't fed regularly and diligently, they won't survive. And God likes ravens, and He wants ravens to go on propagating. So who's going to feed the ravens? Who's going to worry about all of them? Dober, you got a computer program that manages ravens? I don't think so. Now it even gets a little more interesting here, because we'll get into animal obstetrics and let's see, Job, what you understand about that. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? That's the ibex, these wild goats that live on rocky high places, and they have them in Israel even now, where they scale these impossible cliffs and go up and live in places that humans can hardly get to at all. And who takes care of them? And who knows, do you know about their mating and the gestation period of the young, and how the mother delivers the young and takes care of them? Can you manage that? Are you a good manager of that? In a way, Adam was supposed to be the manager over the creation. He was supposed to understand these things. Well, obviously, that's long gone. That's lost to us. Can you mark when the deer gives birth? Well, you could get on the internet and quick find out a little facts about these things, but that wouldn't mean that you could control them or manage them or take care of them, would it? Can you number the months that they fulfill, or know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain, they depart and do not return to them. Isn't it just incredible that many forms of many animals can have their young, and the young immediately leap up on their feet and are self-sufficient and know how to, in some cases, fend for themselves right away? They don't have to be cared for. Human beings have to be cared for 20 years or something like that. You know, we're so helpless, and 20 years even, some like to stay longer than that, leech off of mom and dad, but you can't take a newborn baby child and turn it loose, but you can take all these newborn animals, just leap right out of the womb of their mother, and they go grazing in the grass right away. Horse gets right up on its feet right away. Time plus chance plus natural selection. How ridiculous that is, you see. How absurd that time plus chance and natural process could bring that all about. Bring about that whole process. Isn't it just amazing how animals have got all this built right into them? All the survival skills, how mother animals know how to rear their young. And there are animals. I was watching a program last night, an adventure in Africa, with a guy named Bear Grylls. He's quite a rugged guy. He parachutes into remote, dangerous places, and he parachuted into Africa, and there were the hippopotami protecting their young in the river, and the rhinoceros mother protecting her young, and the great, huge elephants protecting their young from this little man that was going to walk through their territory, and the lions taking care of their young, and imagine that. Great, huge hippopotamus worrying about its babies, that maybe you might harm them. But that instinct of care and mothering is in all animals. It's just wonderful. Verse 5. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? The onager is an animal that I think still exists in Israel today. It's a kind of an agile wild donkey who is not friendly to man. Yeah. Them elephants. I don't think there are any elephants in here. They are. Gestation period is about a year, I think, isn't it, for an elephant? Or longer. And this little calf comes out, and this great mother takes care of it. And the whales, or the porpoises, or the great, how about a great mother whale with a little calf? How in the world can she make sure that calf is nursed and the calf gets up and gets air? How does she manage all that without any chips, no computer chips in there? How does she know to do that? Where does that come from? Well, we're supposed to stand in awe at our Creator, and if we're supposed to stand in awe at the God of nature, this is supposed to provoke worship. This is supposed to make us humble and stand in awe of our great God. And remember way back in Romans 1, the first thing that goes wrong with human beings is that they lose their worship. They lose your sense of intimacy and awe and worship with God, and some other God crowds in and takes God's place in your heart. That's how the human race begins to break down, is the loss of worship, reverence, and awe for God. How worship is the principal activity of heaven, being in awe of this incredible God who makes worlds beyond worlds beyond worlds. Well, that's what's going on here with Job. He's coming back into a sense of reverence and wonder and awe before God. And when you have this view of God, then your own problems, no matter how painful they might be, are going to pale in comparison. Now, the onager, whose home I made for the wilderness, God made this particular wild donkey to live out in the wilderness, so he's not friendly to human beings. He doesn't even have to go near people. He doesn't like people any. He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. You can't put him in a herd and drive him around like you can sheep. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. He can run out and take care of himself, and he doesn't like people, and he's a loner, and he knows where to go and find grass and take care of himself and how to have young. And unrelated to what we're up to, unrelated to cities and people, will the wild ox be willing to serve you? The wild ox is an animal that's now extinct, the auroch, extinct since 1627. It's like a big cow with great horns. We've got pictures of them. A wild cattle that do not like to be domesticated is what these great animals were like, and they were large. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you invite this ox into your manger? Would he come and be home with your domestic cows? Not at all. Would he, if you called him at milking time, would he come in to be milked and be fed? No, he wouldn't. This is a wild cow. He doesn't hang out. Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes, or will he plow the valleys behind you? Can you harness this kind of a wild ox up to your plow and have him cooperate with you and plow your fields? No way. No way. This is an untamable wild animal, and you can't even get near him. Will you trust him because his strength is great, or will you leave your labor to him? Could you assign him the job of plowing the South 40 today and just harness him up to plow and he'd go plow it for you? Well, obviously not. It's a lot of hard work to take a domestic ox and teach him to plow and get him to do the work, and it's a lot of hard work managing him, isn't it? Before deer and caterpillar tractors came along. So God didn't intend that some of these animals should be domesticated. He made them for his own pleasure and for his own purposes. They've got their own life independent of us. Can you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Would he be your servant? Not at all. No way. Can you delegate your work to this? And they're, of course, noted for being fairly stupid. The proverbial ostrich with his head in the sand, puts his head in the sand and thinks there's no danger because his head's buried and the whole big bird is up out of the ground. That's the usual cartoon. And God designed this ostrich, I don't know, maybe just out of good humor. Why would you build an ostrich? And he didn't build it for our pleasure. He built it for his own pleasure. And here's this ostrich who waves her wings proudly. Did you ever see them flap their wings? Well, they can't fly, but they can sure flap their wings. And they've got the great, big, ungainly birds with great, long, spindly legs and this big head, these huge eyes up on the top. Her wings and her pinions are like the kindly storks. The stork can fly very well, but the ostrich can't. And the ostrich lays her eggs out on the ground. It doesn't bother to build a nest. Sometimes ostriches will dig a common hole in the ground, and all the mother ostriches will put their eggs in the common egg, and so you don't know which one's yours. Well, ostriches are smarter than you think, but God's playing a little joke here with Job. He says, She leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust, and she forgets that a foot may crush them. In other words, she appears to just drop her eggs wherever she pleases and goes off, and she can even step on one and break it, and she wouldn't even know it. And she doesn't think about her eggs maybe being devoured by a wild beast. Ostrich eggs can make a beautiful omelet, and all kinds of animals would love to have a nice ostrich egg. And she just drops her eggs and goes away, and it appears to be indifferent. And then her young are born. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. So when the chicks are born and they clamor after mother, she says, "I don't recognize you. You must belong to that other ostrich over there." She leaves them to fend for themselves. Her labor is in vain without concern. She doesn't seem to be knowing what she's doing because God deprived her of wisdom. God is speaking, but he doesn't say, "I deprived her of wisdom." Here he says, "God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and rider." Now, ostriches can run faster than a man and faster than most horses. And an ostrich can kick and disembowel a human being right in no time at all. And so it's not a good idea to mess around with an ostrich. And in spite of her stupidity, her young survive. And we still have ostriches in the world, and for all her carelessness and lack of wisdom, ostriches manage to reproduce. Who takes care of them? God's taking care of the ostriches. They're beautiful birds. You can ride them. I think a good Australian ride an ostrich, not very comfortable, but they're... And I saw somebody catching ostriches at an ostrich farm, and you put a hood over their heads, and then they become a little more docile and easy to manage. But you must be careful to watch out for their kicking. So what strange animal. Why in the world would you ever make an ostrich? Why would an ostrich come about by natural selection? Isn't it neat to have some strange animals around like ostriches? To be able to take the kids to the zoo and the park. Let's finish this chapter and then we'll quit. Then there's the horse. Now we're talking about that great, marvelous, big war horse. "Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened. Nor does he turn back from the sword." These are great war horses that don't hesitate to ride into battle in all the tumult of battle. This great charging horse is unafraid of anything. "He mocks at fear and is not frightened. He does not turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage. He does not stand firm because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, 'Aha!' He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting." The horse is charging and waiting to go and waiting to be turned loose into the battle. So there's this mighty, wonderful horse. Now, there are wild horses in the world and there are tamed horses in the world. And to tame a horse and make a horse into a wonderful animal to ride is a beautiful art. The horses like that if you train them right. And incredible animals, wonderful animals. So we get a little bit on the hawk here. "Does the hawk fly by your wisdom?" You just watch the hawk circling. They have hawks over on the other side of skyline and circling high with that eyesight that can see a mouse or a rabbit way thousands of feet below. "Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Do you know about the migration of birds? Can you handle the annual migration of the birds that they know by instinct when to go north or south? Does the eagle mount up at your command?" You can't even get near the eagle and its nest. "It makes its nest on high. It dwells on the rock and resides on the crag of the rock and the stronghold." Hardly even hike up to the eagle's nest. "From there it spies out its prey." It has incredible eyesight for seeing its prey. "And swooping down, its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is." So those are the birds of prey, the ostriches and the hawks and the vultures and the eagles that can swoop down and also are the birds of carrion. Who manages all of that? Who manages that? chapter 40 is really a break in the whole theme, and for the first time, God will begin to bring moral arguments into the picture. There's been nothing here so far about man's relationship with God, and now in chapter 40, next time, we'll get a little bit of that more deeper challenge. Okay? Good for you to read a few times over the holiday. See?